You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
An opium merchant from Bombay who's made a home for himself in Canton, China, is at the heart of the much-anticipated second book of a trilogy that Amitav Ghosh has written, set in the 1830s and the time leading up to the Opium Wars. The first novel in the series, Sea of Poppies, was shortlisted for the Man Booker Prize. The new book, called River of Smoke, has been receiving rave reviews as well. It's published by Farrar, Straus & Giroux, and I'm very pleased that it has brought Amitav Ghosh back to our show today. Hello.
Hello, Leonard. Thanks for having me.
It's been about 3 years since you were here to talk about Sea of Poppies. Is that the amount of time that it typically takes you to write a novel?
Well, yes. In general, it takes me between 3 and 4 years. Sea of Poppies took a bit longer. It was on the longer side, 4 years. But I should explain that, you know, these books are not in any sense a sort of linear narrative, you know. They're each a sort of self-contained book in its own right.
And although you've included some characters from the first book in this one, the story's main character, Bahram Modi, didn't appear at all in the first novel.
Not really. There were sort of references to him. His son, his illegitimate son, you know, half Chinese, half Indian, was a major character in the first book. But Behram just makes a kind of shadow appearance in the first, and this he's the protagonist of this one.
And you say his illegitimate son. It's actually, he has a family in Canton, separate from the family he's left back home. That's really his more serious family, isn't it? He seems to be more in love with his Chinese wife than he is with his Indian wife.
I think it's a very complex thing, actually. I mean, you know, with his wife in India, he does have a sort of intense familial relationship. They have children. He feels a deep sense of attachment and commitment to her. And similarly, when he's in Canton with his Chinese wife, mistress, whatever you call it, he also has a very deep sense of attachment, and she's given him a son, which he hasn't had. And so it's a very complex set of emotions, I think.
Well, he wouldn't be a businessman if he hadn't married the Indian wife, comes from a wealthy family. So to some degree, it was also a marriage of convenience. But this is not, would it have been seen as an arranged marriage as well?
Completely. It was absolutely an arranged marriage. I mean, she was going to marry into another very rich family. She comes from a very large, very powerful ship-owning family. And she was going to marry another very rich family. But her prospective groom died shortly before the marriage. So, you know, she becomes associated with bad luck. So.
And Bahram works for his father-in-law's shipping company. He's convinced his father-in-law to let him use the company's ships to transport and sell opium in China. Because these books, this series, is really about opium poppies, poppies and opium in the middle, or the first third of the 19th century. You said originally that you'd planned to cover something like 35 years, but you have two books that have covered something like 18 months. So
that's absolutely true, yes.
So does that mean that we may see more books than you originally imagined?
I don't really know where it's going to take me, you know. I mean, every time I get to the end of one of the books, with these books as with any other book, I just feel completely exhausted by it, really.
Well, how much do you know when you start? For example, in the October 7th review of the book in the New York Times, Chandrahas Choudhury called Bahram Modi the most memorable character in all of your fiction. He was only referred to in the first book. Did you have any, when you were writing the first book, did you think that you would then make him the central character in the second book?
I didn't know that he would become the central character, as it were, but he was a character I thought about very early. And in fact, when I started writing Sea of Poppies, he was one of the first characters I sketched. You know, and
then you just left him out.
There was no space for him in Sea of Poppies, in a sense. But
and that was a big book.
That was a very big book with lots of characters, but there was no room for him there.
So we're really talking about the opium trade. Now, Chinese people are very aware of the Opium Wars because it's so important in their history. It really changed China from being one of the the economic powerhouses of the world into the sick country that it was in for many years to follow. How well known is India's involvement in the opium trade in India?
Oh, it's not known at all. In fact, I mean, to the world at large, the whole fact that, you know, all the 90% of the opium that went to China came from India, that itself was, I think, very, very little known. In general, you know, the reality of the opium trade, the part it played in forming a modern capitalism and the modern world, all of that is just obscured and occluded.
Well, should we assume that's because it was a time when Britain and other Western European countries and the United States acted in ways that many of us would rather not remember?
Absolutely, absolutely. Because, you know, in general, when one speaks about, you know, historical moments and, historical ideologies, for example, you know, you often say such and such ideology, you know, had resulted in such horrors and so many deaths. But the ideology of free trade and what it resulted in, it's never associated in that way. And it resulted in maybe over 100 million deaths.
England insisted on free trade and forced the Chinese to accept the opium trade?
They did. They actually made war upon China. They first expanded the opium cultivation in India because they were facing this balance of payments problem with China, just as they do today, and then made war upon China to force them to continue to import opium, yes.
Should we in the United States feel proud that we were not the ones who did that?
The United States was hugely involved in the opium trade.
You say Brooklyn.
Brooklyn was involved.
You live in Brooklyn.
I do. And some of the opium traders' houses are not far from where I live. Massachusetts was hugely involved. Some of your most important families. There was one of the biggest traders in Canton in the 19th century was a man called Andrew Delano. Well, he was the grandfather of FDR, you know. So there was a deep, deep involvement with the opium trade in America.
In this story, Bahram, when it begins, Bahram is attempting to sail the ship, the Anahita, which is a custom-built ship that belongs to his father-in-law. It's loaded with some 3,000 chests of opium, and he's taking it to Canton. He's used his life savings to buy as much opium as he can in an attempt to make his fortune with a single shipment, and then things go wrong.
Yes, because he arrives in China in 1838. The Chinese tried repeatedly to put an end to the opium trade.
The emperor had opium confiscated, but it wasn't successful?
That was in 1838. But earlier than that also, they tried very, very hard to stop the opium trade. But every time they sort of failed. So Behram assumes that they're going to fail again and that all it's going to do is drive up the prices. But this time, the emperor is really adamant, and he sends this amazing bureaucrat, a mandarin called Lin Zexu, who actually does confiscate the opium.
And he also has to deal with a storm, and I wondered if it was the same storm that we had in the first book.
Yes, in fact, it is the same storm. It's the same storm that overtakes the Ibis from the first book, and this is a storm is over 100 miles in breadth, if you like. So,
now this is a very serious story, but much of the book is really funny. The foreign-born merchants you've depicted go to extremes to justify their behavior during their discussions about free trade. When you started writing this, did you have any idea of some of the arguments that they were using? You quote real sources.
Absolutely, absolutely. In many, many parts of the book, I actually use the words that the merchants use to justify their involvement in the opium trade. I think you can't make up that stuff, you know. I mean, in fact, they're all talking about free trade as though it was some sort of evangelical ideology, and they all feel that they have a right to import opium into China, that it's a God-given right. And I don't think I could actually make that stuff up.
Well, in some ways, it sounds like some of the arguments we're hearing today in the political debate.
You're absolutely right. You know, I've been going to visit these Occupy protests, not just here in New York, but also in Seattle and San Francisco. And what's very interesting to me is that, in some sense, they're at last questioning, you know, these issues. I mean, of free trade, of liberalization, because one of the bizarre things about these ideologies is that they seem to be presented to us now as if they had no history. And, you know, they had this long history of destruction and, you know, terrible wrongdoing.
In his Washington Post review of your book, Shashi Tharoor said that your trilogy is, I'm quoting, emerging as a monumental tribute to the pain and glory of an earlier era of globalization.
Yes,
does Thomas Friedman know about that?
I don't know. I have no idea.
But you're saying, is this when globalization really started becoming a factor in world trade?
Globalization has always existed, you know. I mean, one of my first books was called In an Antique Land, and it was about the 12th century, and it was about a Jewish merchant from Egypt who went to live in India. And, you know, especially the China trade has been the motor of the world economy for centuries, really. So that hasn't changed at all.
It also leads to a lot of diversity in some of these areas. And you appear to have had fun writing in the dialects in use by a wide variety of people who lived in Funky Town. It's F-A-N-Q-U-I, not funky.
Yes. Well, that's the name that I use in my book. It was actually called the 13 Factories. It's the foreign enclave in Canton. And it was really one of the most diverse, one of the most cosmopolitan places in the whole world. I mean, you know, there were people from Europe, there were people from all over Asia. And it was an incredibly interesting place, and with all sorts of interesting things happening there.
This is Canton before Hong Kong, which is the island off of that, now called Guangdong?
No, this was called...
Canton is a city.
It's called Guangzhou. And it has always existed, but the European name for it was Canton, which came from Guangdong, which is the name of the province.
But that was then more important city than Hong Kong, which became a major city after the British took it over.
Hong Kong was founded as a result of the Opium Wars. It was founded as a place from which to ship opium into China. And Hong Kong has had a good run, but I think Guangzhou is soon going to overtake Hong Kong in its importance.
Again, because it's become such an important manufacturing center now?
I mean, Guangzhou is an astonishing city. And it's not just one city. I mean, that whole area between Guangzhou and Hong Kong, the Shenzhen area, it's just one of the world's most busy industrial places.
Now, you tell the story in two voices. Much of it's told by an omniscient narrator, but some of it is through the letters written by a person named Robin Chinnery, a witty and somewhat outlandish gay artist. Why did you choose that character to help tell the story?
Well, for many reasons. George Chinnery was a great artist who, lived part of his life in India and a part of his life in China.
Oh, this is a real person.
Oh, yes. He was one of the great artists of the 19th century. You know, he was a contemporary of Hoppner and Rayburn and so on. He was a truly great artist, perhaps not so well known in the West because he spent much of his life in the East. But he did have a son, two sons with an Indian mistress. And, one of them did go to visit him in China. So, you know, that's what I founded Robin Chinnery on. But it was, you know, this enclave, the foreign enclave in Canton, was an all-male enclave. It had to be because by law, foreign merchants weren't allowed to bring their families there. And, you know, it was a kind of strangely campy place. I mean, you can see that in the letters and journals of the, of the merchants who were there. They're always dancing with each other and, you know, they have these sort of very tender relationships with each other. So it was fun to have, someone like Robin Chinnery reporting on it.
You divide your time among the Indian cities of Kolkata and Goa and then Brooklyn, New York. Do you write in all those places?
Yes, I do most of my writing in Goa and in Brooklyn. And yes, that's the situation for me now.
And Kolkata, it's kind of a dangerous city, isn't it?
Kolkata? No, it's not dangerous at all. It's a city where there's a lot of poverty, but as in most Indian cities, the crime rates are very, very low. Quite startlingly low, really.
This book was also the first book was shortlisted for the Man Booker.
Yes.
Was this book also on the list?
No, it wasn't.
Why did they put it on the list?
Well, I don't know. I mean, these things are, they're just bingo, really.
I'm just saying it's a wonderful book. River, and got great reviews. Congratulations. River of Smoke, Amitav Ghosh's second part of a trilogy that may go longer, published by Farrar, Straus & Giroux. It's always a pleasure to talk with you.
Thank you very much, Leonard. Thank you.